You're listening to Campus Killings, brought to you by Abject Entertainment. Be sure to check out some of the other great true crime podcasts from this network, including The Murder in My Family,
DNA ID, Zodiac Speaking,
Scene of the Crime, Missing Persons,
Beyond Bizarre True Crime,
and Citizen Detective. All of these podcasts are available for you to binge on right now, wherever you listen to podcasts. Subscribe where you're listening to this podcast so you don't miss an episode.
Hi, everyone. Today's case takes us back to Penn State University. Last season, we covered a cold case from there, but we'll be returning to Penn State to unpack a case that we don't normally see, a female perpetrator. Megan, how often would you say we see mass shootings have a female perpetrator?
So rarely. I mean, mass shootings are already, believe it or not, still considered a rare phenomenon as they take up a smaller percentage of shootings, but a female mass shooter is incredibly rare.
I want to say there's only maybe four on the books that I'm aware of. So this is an episode that is very unique. Before we get started, as always, let's get a sense of our surroundings. Founded in 1985 as the Farmers High School of Pennsylvania, Penn State was created from a federal land grant. Now, don't be confused by the high school term. It was a college-level institution, specifically for higher education and agricultural studies. In 1863, it was then expanded by a second land grant, and the name was changed to the Agricultural College of Pennsylvania. By the 1870s, the name had changed yet again, now to Pennsylvania State College, and after increased expansions in the 20th century, it gained university status in 1953. Today, Penn State is the largest university in Pennsylvania, with 24 different campuses throughout the state. Although the one that we're focusing on in this episode is the main campus, located in a town known as State College. While the university is known for graduating students in engineering, medicine, and law, the school has a more notorious history as it was the home of the 2011 sports sex abuse scandal.
Jerry Sandusky, right?
Yep. But several years before Penn State came under fire for a cover-up of these horrendous sex abuse allegations, the university came under a literal fire by a 19-year-old girl named Jillian Robbins. There isn't much documentation on Jillian's early childhood, but several sources agree that her parents divorced when she was quite young. And unfortunately, it was a very messy custody situation where she was constantly bounced back and forth between her mother's house and her father's house. Jillian had also suffered from depression from a very young age. It wasn't until 10th grade and things worsened when she started having hallucinations where she would hear people talking when nobody was there, and she would also see what she described as tall, dark people with dark coats and no eyes.
I'm sorry, can you say that part again? What did you just say?
She started having hallucinations where she would hear people talking when no one was there, and she would also see what she described as tall, dark people with dark coats and no eyes. At one point in her teen years, she tried suicide and she was placed in a psychiatric ward for treatment. Now, it's unclear if either of her parents were aware of the depth of her depression or even knew of her hallucinations. I couldn't find any evidence that they took her to counseling or got her medical assistance prior to the psychiatric commitment that I just mentioned. And later on, her father would deny knowing that she was suffering from any mental health issues. Now, this doesn't mean her mother didn't know or didn't do anything. I just could not find a record of it.
Okay.
Either way, 2 years after her time in the psychiatric hospital, in the spring of 1994, Jillian went to an Army recruiting office and enlisted in the U.S. Army Reserves. Now, the military does have a series of questions on their application about a potential recruit's mental health and stability.
Yeah.
However, Jillian lied on the paperwork and did not disclose that she had been committed or that she had had suicidal ideations.
And they're not going to verify that?
Well, because her history was not disclosed, the Army Reserves admitted her, and she went away to that summer's 10-week basic training camp where she specialized in sniper rifle training. So no, Megan, they did not verify that. They just took her word for it.
Okay.
And as one would likely expect, upon her return, her mental health was worse than it was when she left. In her own words, she recalls, quote, "They'd pretty much take anyone and then break them down and turn them into someone who could kill." She also recalls going back to her senior year of high school after the training, feeling a lot more aggressive. Now, this isn't good. We have mental health instability, and now we have training and, you know, an army training, so firearms training, and she's saying that she's feeling aggressive.
I don't like that statement about feeling aggressive. I guess that's not, that doesn't sit well.
No, and I don't know who she said that to or if it was taken seriously or not, but she ended up not completing her senior year. And the Army Reserve subsequently discharged her for not obtaining her high school diploma because that was part of the deal. There was also one reference to her having employment in town, but I couldn't find anything specific. So it's a bit of a mystery on how she was spending her time in this post-school, post-military time in her life. There are several accounts that point to Jillian and her father going hunting together. And Meg, as you could attest to, in Pennsylvania, this is not out of the norm. Hunting is a huge recreational sport.
Yes, hunting is not out of the norm here at all.
I don't know if Jillian's father took her hunting when she was a child or if this sport was something she'd come to after her military training, but we do know that's how she was spending some of her time at least. And around this time when she was discharged from the reserves, her father gifted her one of the family's hunting rifles, a German-made 7mm Mauser. Jillian recalls her dad specifically saying to her, "Don't sell it and don't shoot anybody," as he gave it to her. But a year later, she would defy her father and turn this gun on the unsuspecting students of Penn State.
I'm confused, Amy, because she hadn't finished high school yet, so she's not a student at Penn State, or is she somehow taking a program there? Like, what's her relation to the campus?
You're correct, Megan. She was not affiliated with the school. In fact, she had never enrolled at Penn State, but she did live in the campus's shadow only 3 miles away. And she was seeing a psychologist named Dr. Wadlington, and he was in town near the campus. I also found one article that stated that Jillian's mother worked as a staff member for the university. So it is possible that Jillian had spent some time on campus, but we know that she definitely was familiar with the area.
Okay.
On Tuesday, September 17th, 1996, Jillian Roberts woke up deciding that she no longer wanted to live. And she would later say, quote, "I could not handle the stresses of life. I could not handle the hallucinations, the delusions anymore." The sky was gray and threatening rain as she strapped a knife to her hip and her Mauser rifle to her back before putting on a large rain poncho. She left her home at Turtle Creek Apartments around 7:45 a.m. and walked the 3 miles to Penn State University's main campus. And it's believed that she was living with her dad at the time in this apartment. Jillian walked into town and stopped at a local market to buy a juice and a morning paper before heading to the hub. This was a park-like courtyard that connected different buildings in the middle of the university. Jillian arrived at the hub around 9:30 a.m. and she found a secluded spot behind a row of bushes. She laid out her poncho like a picnic blanket, and then she proceeded to sit and drink her juice while reading the paper, and her rifle was laying right next to her.
Do you have any grudges towards anyone on this campus that you could find?
Nope. There's no real known relation to the campus other than that it was nearby.
All right.
Jillian would later recall that in the months before September 17th, she had been having urges to, quote, "commit random acts of violence." And even though she had disclosed this to her therapist, as well as admitting her ownership of the firearm, she claimed that the doctor did not take her statement seriously.
Do you think that's because she was a female?
It could be. You know, this is just when you hear stories like this, it's so sad when it could have been prevented.
Right.
If only, right? So as Jillian sat under the branches, leaning on a tree, she felt what she referred to as an explosion of insane rage, and she says she acted on it.
But this was still premeditated. She brought the gun with her, so I'm just saying there's premeditation here.
Yeah.
And now, a brief word from our sponsors.
She rolled herself into the sniper position on her poncho and aimed at a random student through a gap in the bushes. That student was Melanie Spella, a 21-year-old senior who was only two semesters away from completing her BA in journalism. She had just left Spanish class and was walking through the hub on her way to her next class. Several other students were also walking through the hub, either on their way to breakfast or coming out of an early morning class. And Jillian fired quickly. She hit Melanie in the back, and then she hit a second student, Nicholas Menza, a 22-year-old sophomore business major. He was hit in the stomach. Both of the students immediately fell when they were hit, and chaos erupted on the hub as students scattered and ran for cover. One girl named Holly Garlitz actually dragged Nicholas Menza with her under the cover of some bushes and tried to stop his bleeding. Jillian fired off three more shots, grazing two other students' backpacks and another embedding itself in a windowsill of a local Methodist church. But as she blindly loaded a new magazine into her firearm, a shadow fell over her. This was Brandon Malov, a 21-year-old aerospace engineering major who had taken a route around the hub to get some breakfast when he heard what he thought was fireworks coming from behind a hedge of bushes. But when he investigated the noise, he found Jillian Robbins. In Brendan's later interviews, he recalled making eye contact with the girl and realizing, that's a rifle in her hands. She's been shooting people. He then quickly dove for her and ripped the magazine out of her hands.
Oh my God.
This guy's a hero.
Yep. Okay. Yeah.
After a brief struggle, he was able to wrestle the rifle away from Jillian. But as he threw the gun away, Jillian pulled a knife from her hip and tried to stab him. He grappled with her for several minutes, in which she accidentally stabbed herself in the thigh. Luckily, Brendan was able to take the opening to completely subdue Jillian, as well as used his belt as a tourniquet on her thigh to stop the bleeding. He also secured the rifle and the knife away from Jillian and sat talking to her on the grass until police arrived a few minutes later.
Wow. Oh, I didn't see that coming. Okay.
All right. So you have a 21-year-old man who not only got the gun away from this girl, also was able to get the knife, subdue her, and really keep her calm until the police arrives.
This guy is amazing.
Incredible. And the police response was incredibly quick, with only maybe 5 minutes having passed from the initial shot to first responders arriving on the scene. Now, like most large universities, Penn State does have its own police force, and they were the unit who both responded to and later would investigate the shooting. There was very little intel to begin with, as Penn State had never had to deal with an incident like this at any point in its history. And this was also, Megan, before Columbine or any of the other school shootings of the late 90s. So there really wasn't a precedent for this kind of situation. The police were only armed with revolvers when they burst onto the hub. But thanks to Brendan, the shooting had stopped by the time police arrived, and they were able to secure the scene and get help to the hurt student in an incredible time. Very sadly, Melanie Spella was pronounced dead at the scene as the bullet had hit her in the back of the neck, killing her instantly. But Nicholas Menza was still alive. And while Brendan had been trying to get the gun away from Jillian, several faculty, staff, and students had come running out of the student nursing building on the edge of the hub and performed life-saving measures on Nicholas until he could be transported to the local hospital. Nicholas underwent 2 hours of surgery upon arrival, but he would go on to make a full physical recovery.
Oh, well, that's due to the incredible bravery of that young man, that 21-year-old kid.
Yep.
I'm still kind of like mind blown over that one.
Jillian, of course, was taken into police custody, and the responding officer, William Morsbacher, recalls, quote, I drew my weapon and pointed it at her, and she was ignoring me. It got a little tense there. She eventually did what I told her to do. I think she was in a bit of shock, in hindsight. She had a big, gaping wound and had just shot at people. But to me, it didn't matter. She had shot someone. I saw a gun there. After being taken to the hospital for her leg injury, Jillian was placed under psychological assessment, and police questioned her motives for the shooting. But all she could tell them was, I don't know. I don't know. She also claimed that she had never met the two students that she had gunned down, nor any of the other young people walking through the hub that morning. But Megan, even if there was no connection between Jillian and any of the students at Penn State, she had turned the hub into a crime scene.
Yeah. I'm assuming you're going to get to this about possible motivations or, you know, what may have prompted this attack.
Well, at this point, the police were able to establish that there was no known relationship between the shooter and the victims, and no known really relationship between even the shooter and the school in which she was shooting at. Police immediately started questioning any witnesses that they could find, and they would accumulate over 100 individual testimonies. And the crime scene soon expanded past the hub and into a nearby apartment complex and a local church. And this was due to bullet ricochets. Within a few days, all the questions about the logistics of the incident were resolved, and police assured the student body that there was no threat to the public. However, Megan, things didn't go back to normal on the Penn State campus. Brendan recalls that event becoming a huge stressor on campus, and while their routines went back to normal only a few days later, he says that, quote, the campus itself was the same place, but people felt weird about it being the same place.
Of course. I mean, it's still physically the same, but to everyone, the significance and being there, I'm sure there was really a very big change in the way people felt about being there at that time. So, Amy, what happens with Jillian? I mean, was there a trial? Was there a sanity evaluation? I'm going to assume they're going for her. She would have a defense that would go for insanity claims here.
She was arraigned and charged with first degree murder, third degree murder, attempted murder, and aggravated assault. And her case was considered to be a capital offense, which means that it was a death eligible. In other words, they have the death penalty in Pennsylvania. So this was a death eligible case.
Were they pursuing death penalty, the prosecution?
Well, the district attorney said that Jillian knowingly created grave risk of death to others in addition to the victim of the murder. The DA also dictated that Jillian would be ineligible for bail. However, as you hinted at, while awaiting trial, Jillian was committed to the Norristown State Hospital for mental evaluation to see if she was competent to stand trial. Now, competency to stand trial is different than insanity.
Yes.
Insanity is a defense claim saying that an individual is not culpable because they were insane at the time of a crime. Whereas competency to stand trial means, is the individual in a mental state where they can assist in their own defense?
Yes.
So at first, her stay was only for about 90 days, but as we often see, it got pushed back to 6 months for additional evaluation. And in total, she underwent 20 months of mental evaluation before being deemed competent to even continue with court proceedings.
Okay.
Now, what do you think? Do you think she ends up going to trial?
I think she would probably have to with insanity claims. I just can't see another way around this.
Well, we don't know yet if she's claiming insanity, right? Because we're just talking about competency. We assumed she would go for the insanity defense.
So, yes, but I think it goes to trial with an insanity claim.
Okay, that's actually what I would have guessed as well. But since the evidence was pretty cut and dry, Jillian opted for a plea deal, and she pled guilty to third-degree murder and attempted murder on four other students. Now, what's interesting here is that the prosecution agreed to the lesser plea of third-degree murder because they were really concerned that a jury would find her not guilty by insanity. And they did not want to take that risk because they believed that she was a danger to the public.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say that's true. I would say she probably was still a danger or could be a danger, but I am still surprised that her defense didn't try for insanity. Maybe they were just too afraid to roll the dice on that one.
Yeah, because remember, death is on the table.
Yeah, okay. That's the reason
why. So I think, maybe perhaps if it wasn't death eligible, then maybe they would have gone to trial, but I think this was probably the right move. And I can understand why the prosecution was worried if she was found not guilty, right? They wanted to see her put away. They wanted to see her be safely away from the public.
Yes.
And on May 22nd, 1998, Jillian Robbins was sentenced to 30 to 60 years. She is currently serving her time at the State Correction Facility in Muncie, Pennsylvania. And as far as I could tell, no appeals or early releases have ever been discussed. But Megan, she will be eligible for parole in 2028, which is not that far from where we are right now.
No, but how old will she be at the time?
She was 19 years old in 96.
So she'll be eligible after serving about 30 years.
Yes, of course, because she was sentenced 30 to 60 years.
I mean, we don't know what's happened in 30 years. I have no idea. I would assume that one of the conditions, if she ever does get parole, is that she has to undergo mental health treatment probably for the rest of her life. She probably has to remain on supervision for the rest of her life. Mm-hmm. I would think they'll, you know, her conditions, if she's paroled, which she may not be because of the notoriety of the case mm-hmm. too, and because of how serious it is, and possibly yeah. she's a threat. I just assume that she would be under the most restrictive of conditions. Mm-hmm.
And I think it would matter what she has done. 30 years, that's a long time for her to be rehabilitated and also on the right medications and the right therapeutic plan, that she might be, you know, ready to be released to the public in 2028.
We'll return after a brief word from our sponsors.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a Swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
So that's what's going on with Jillian Robbins. But as we see in other cases, the situation doesn't always end after the perpetrator goes to prison, right? So there's a little more to talk about here.
But before you do, Amy, I really have a question. This is just bugging me. I guess I just don't understand. She said that she didn't want to live anymore. But why did she want to kill other people? We just, because of the plea, we don't get the motivations, the true motivations revealed to us. Is that the case?
Yes, Megan, this is one of those cases where, you know, she hasn't, as far as I'm aware of or was able to access, she hasn't done interviews from prison. I'm not really sure what her mindset is, or, you know, there's just not a lot regarding, you know, the motivations.
All right.
2 years after the shooting, Melanie Spella's parents sued Jillian's father for giving Jillian the gun. They also took out a suit against Jillian's therapist, Dr. Wadlington, and his associates. However, Melanie's family was unsuccessful in both suits, with a court judge ruling that neither Jillian's father or her therapist could be held liable for her actions. What do you think about this?
I think they are in part responsible, to be honest, yes. And I mean, you know, I have mixed views on firearms. I don't know at what level they are culpable, but I do think with the threats being made that the therapist ignored threats, and that's, I think there's some responsibility here. And I also think her father put a firearm into a hand of someone who probably shouldn't have had a firearm. So while it's a tragedy all around, and while I'm sure they didn't, you know, they could not have foreseen the consequences, I do think there's some level of responsibility they both have in this tragedy.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. As we often talk about on the show, the shooting here did create some new protocols. So there were some new security protocols for Penn State Police.
Yeah, I would imagine.
So one of the first police on the scene explained that, quote, "At the time, if there was a shooting or hostage situation, a patrol officer's job was to create a perimeter and to call in help. But we can't count on that. You have to fight with the army you have and try to stop it from happening, because we know right now that there's just people who will go in and kill anybody they can." So protocols had to change in case something of this magnitude would ever happen again. And all campus police were given new training and tactics classes, as well as weapons upgrade from revolvers to semi-automatic pistols and patrol rifles. And today, campus police educate the campus population with a training guide called the Penn State Active Attacker Response Program, as well as the creation of a behavioral threat management team that encourages people to report concerning behavior so they can be connected with the appropriate resources. This incident also spawned a new digital system of correspondence between campus administrators and the public. Now, this may seem a little strange to us today, as we use the internet for basically everything, but in 1996, the internet was only 5 years old and not readily used as a form of communication, particularly on college campuses. However, this shooting changed that, as administrators realized as the incident was happening that they needed a quick way to get information to students and to the surrounding town. In the immediate aftermath of the incident, administrators created a webpage specifically for information on the shooting. And interestingly, many of the news stories that came out after the incident relied on the university's webpage for their information. And that's not all, Megan. The university also implemented a hotline for parents, allowing strategic communications to immediately be disseminated. And many campuses now have these kinds of hotlines implemented. But before this incident, Penn State didn't have anything like this. Counseling services on campus were also heavily expanded in order to help students and faculty process the trauma, as well as to provide help to those who are feeling mentally unstable. As Lisa Powers, the director of news and media relations for Penn State, remembers, quote, "A lot of things were put in motion. You cannot plan for everything. There was a general plan for emergency, but I don't think anyone at that point in 1996 ever envisioned such a random act on campus, such a destructive and horrible act."
I think that's fair. I don't think that that could have been as anticipated then as it could have been now. And it does sound like to me Penn State responded swiftly and with a lot to both prevent future situations and support students who were having to go through the tragedy that happened on campus with Jillian.
I agree. I think this is an example of a university response going actually above and beyond what I would have expected.
I agree.
They didn't stop with just training. They went to every level, looking at it holistically. I think they did a really amazing job.
They're pulling every lever, right? They're looking at the punishment, prevention, education, medical, counseling. They're just pulling every single lever, which is smart.
Yes. And a week after the shooting, they also held a vigil for Melanie Spalla, which was attended by hundreds of students, faculty and staff. And the college president, Graham Spanier, announced the advent of a memorial scholarship in Melanie's name as a way to honor her memory. And his remarks at the ceremony were incredibly poignant, and so much so that I want to share them with you here.
Okay.
Quote, "All of Penn State is greatly saddened and hurt by Melanie's murder. We're also angry that this happened at our university and deeply anxious about the feelings of vulnerability surrounding this tragic event. I cannot explain why this happened, but I know we must honor Melanie by remembering her and by gathering strength in our lives from the joy for life she displayed in hers. While we experienced darkness last week, there was thankfully one light so bright that I must mention it. I saw a level of caring and compassion I have never seen in my lifetime. I witnessed scores of students, faculty, staff, and citizens beyond the university reaching out to each other in support. For Melanie, we must give a little extra to life to compensate in some small way for her loss. For Nicholas, we must be supportive and encourage his healing. And we must pray also for those everywhere who, by virtue of psychological impairment or inadequacy of values, have devalued human life. For everyone in our university family, we must help one another through this tragedy and ultimately carry on." Now, I have to say, you know, these remarks properly talked about the victims, and I think it shows a lot of compassion and bravery to also show some care for, as it says, the psychological impairment or inadequacy of values. So, you know, this is kind of an unpopular opinion when you show any sort of compassion for the offender, but I think these statements do it in such a delicate way, and I really appreciated it.
Yeah, that's really well balanced. It's really not just well balanced, it's just really incredibly thoughtful. And that, look, there is a compassion. You can condemn the sin, but you don't have to necessarily condemn the sinner entirely, right? We condemn, we punish, but it's okay to also feel some compassion for offenders, especially ones that do suffer from really severe mental health disorders. So I think that was a very kind and generous statement.
Yeah, this story definitely left me with a newfound respect for, you know, Penn State in general and their president who made these statements. In the year following the campus attack, Brendan and Holly Garlitz was the girl who pulled Christopher Mensah to safety and helped stop his bleeding. Now, both of them were honored by the Carnegie Hero Fund Commission for their acts of bravery during the shooting. They both received a bronze medal and a $2,500 scholarship. On the 20th anniversary of the shooting, Penn State ran a series called Talking Together About Guns, in which alumni who had been present at the time of the shooting came back to open discussions with current students on their memories of the incident, and this created a space for larger conversations about gun violence in school settings.
That's fantastic. And this is all very positive outcomes from a tragedy. Yeah.
2023 marks 27 years since the shooting, and perhaps because of all the precautions and policies that Penn State implemented after the incident, they have not had another shooting on any of their 24 campuses since. Now, to me, what's most interesting about this case is how Penn State's implementation of all these changes really seemed to help the school stay a safe place, at least from gun violence. I really think it's a testament to them that they learned from the experience and they beefed up their security, but more importantly, they also expanded their counseling services and outreach to those who have been struggling. When we look at Jillian, she unfortunately hits all the major indicators of a mass shooter. She was a loner, highly mentally unstable, and suffering from hallucinations and suicidal ideations. And even though a judge ruled that her father was not liable for her behavior based on him not knowing that his daughter was suffering from such mental anguish, we can maybe talk about where the line is between blaming mental instability and taking personal responsibility in these kinds of situations.
I mean, that's what I was saying before when we discussed the culpability. I am a little bit mixed on it. I do think there's some responsibility here, you know, especially when you have someone who is vulnerable. And but it's hard. At what level do you hold them responsible? Because, look, he didn't do it. I doubt he had any indication that that kind of violence could come from his child. It's a very important conversation, but it's also a very tough one.
Yeah, it's definitely not clear cut.
I don't think it's a clear cut situation at all, but I think it's an important conversation to have.
I agree. And if you would like to give to the Melanie Spalla Scholarship Fund, you can contact Penn State's University Advancement at raise.psu.edu. And if you or anyone you know is struggling with suicidal thoughts or needs assistance, you can call the National Suicide Prevention Hotline at 998, and this is 24/7. Before we go today, if you'd like to support Campus Killings, consider subscribing to the show with an Abjack Insider subscription through Apple Podcasts.
Your subscription will get you VIP access to all the shows on the network that not only includes hundreds of episodes of ad-free listening, but also bonus content and early access to episodes.
For only $4.99 a month or $49.99 a year, you'll unlock a variety of listener benefits and you'll be supporting this show in the process.
Head over to Apple Podcasts and search for either Campus Killings or Abjack and you can start your subscription with a free trial.
Your support is greatly appreciated.
Thank you everyone for listening today and we hope you'll join us on the next episode of Campus Killings.
Campus Killings is hosted by Dr. Megan Sachs and Dr. Amy Schlossberg with research and writing by Abigail Belcastro. It's produced by Mike Morford of Abjack Entertainment. Be sure to follow Campus Killings on social media. You can find Campus Killings on Twitter with the handle @CampusKillings or on Facebook at facebook.com/CampusKillings. You can also visit the show's homepage at CampusKillings.com. Be sure to tune in every other Saturday for new episodes of Campus Killings.